Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. 62 years ago, a poor Black woman, her name was Henrietta Lacks, died of cervical cancer. Just before her death, doctors removed some of her tumor cells, which have since been used in more than 74,000 studies, leading to breakthroughs in cell biology, cancer research, and life-saving vaccines. The only problem is that Henrietta Lacks' cells were taken without permission from her or her family and distributed across the around the world. For decades, her family had no say in how their mother's genome was used, and they couldn't get straight answers from scientists when they asked. That is, until last week, when the National Institutes of Health reached an unprecedented agreement with Henrietta Lacks' descendants. Joining us now to talk about the decision is Rebecca Skloot. Rebecca is a science journalist, and she's the author of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. It's a book that first drew public attention to this case back in 2010. And welcome back to the show, Rebecca.
Thanks for having me back.
Just to refresh people's memories, why were these tumor cells called HeLa cells for Henrietta Lacks end up being so valuable in scientific research?
Well, in part, they were so valuable because they were the first one. So the scientists around the world had been trying to grow human cells outside the body for decades, and it had never worked. And no one knows exactly why, but her cells just never died. Scientists had taken samples from hundreds of people before her, and their cells didn't just grow. And they really revolutionized science in so many different ways. They were used to help develop the polio vaccine. They went up in the first space missions to see what would happen to human cells in zero gravity. Hers were the first cells ever cloned, first genes ever mapped. They were used to create some of our most important cancer medications, you know, in vitro fertilization. The list just goes on and on. And a lot of that is because they were the first one. So it was the first time scientists could use cells that were living outside the body. But also, they just grew with this incredible intensity. So they grow massive quantities of them very fast.
That was it. After that, everyone for cotton, you know, you could always have the same cells, and it was perfect for experimentation. Have they found anyone since Henrietta Lacks whose cells reproduce in this way?
Well, now scientists can actually immortalize someone's cells, so they can take cells from anyone and alter their genes or infect them with certain viruses that can make them become immortal. So, there are a lot of other immortal cell lines out there now, but hers are still unusual. They still grow, they're so hardy in culture when they grow in the lab that they're still the most commonly used one in labs around the world. And also because at this point they're so well studied, scientists know so much about them that they're still the sort of baseline that people start with when they're doing research on cells because, you know, they know what they're getting into. And if you infect a HeLa cells with a cell with a certain virus or you expose it to a drug and it changes, you know where you started. So it's similarly to why we use, you know, fruit flies or white, you know, the lab mice, because they know what they're getting into, and they reproduce so quickly.
The ultimate control. If you're just joining us, this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Rebecca Skloot, science journalist and author of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. We first spoke with Rebecca a couple years old, about 3 years ago now, about her book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. At the time, the family was still grappling with this issue of control. How did they first find out that these cells were being reproduced in this way long after their mother had died?
Yeah, so the story of the HeLa cells and Henrietta and her family has several big ethical moments in it. And the first one was when they took the cells without her consent in the 50s. And in some ways, that's the most straightforward moment. And we didn't really have informed consent back then. They were taking samples from really anyone they could. So it wasn't like they targeted her or she received unusual treatment. But then in the 70s, her family had no idea that these cells had been taken or grown, and she had five kids when she died. And in the 70s, in order to learn more about the cells, a group of scientists tracked down her children and did research on them in order to learn more about the cells. And so then it was a second generation of Lacks's used in research without their knowledge. And, you know, it was a pretty terrifying time for them.
Well, I mean, one of the issues was the Lacks's family, they were very undereducated or ill-educated. Yeah. They really were very unsophisticated.
Yeah, well, and some of this, you know, her husband had a third grade education. He didn't even know what a cell was. He's a tobacco farmer. And, you know, he got this phone call one day saying, we've got your wife's cells. You know, they're alive in a laboratory. And he just didn't know what that meant. You know, the only kind of cell he'd heard of was a prison cell. He thought, well, they have her or part of her in a cell somewhere. And the scientists didn't realize how little he understood about the science. And so it was sort of an enormous communication breakdown in some ways. And then the scientists never stopped to answer their questions. You know, Henrietta's daughter in particular, Deborah Lacks, asked a lot of questions. What does this mean? You know, are my mother's soul, is her soul alive in these cells? Can she feel pain when you inject them with chemicals and, you know, shoot her cells up to the moon? And the scientists just didn't even know how to respond to her family, really.
So what has happened with this decision now? It had something to do with the University of Washington mapping her genome?
Right. So what happened was in March, a group of scientists from Germany at the a lab there called EMBL sequenced the HeLaCell genome. So they mapped out all the genes in the HeLaCells and they published it online where anyone could download it. I could download it, you could download it. And they didn't get permission from the family. And so this was, in a sense, another generation of Black family members being brought into research without their consent. So, you know, Henrietta's genes, even though, you know, these cells were her cancer cells, and there's a lot that's abnormal about the cells' genes, her genes are still in there. You can learn a lot about Henrietta's genetics through those cells, and also then her kids who inherited 50% of those genes, and then her grandkids who inherited some. And so it raised some really big privacy questions. And, you know, so initially this was published online, and I found out about it and contacted the family and said, you know, essentially, I'm guessing you didn't know this was happening. Did anyone contact you? Did you give consent for them to publish this genetic
information? This was even after your book was published.
Yeah, it was. And the family's response was, no, we had no idea this was happening. And they said, we want them to take it offline. And so I contacted the scientists and passed on that information. And they did. They responded very quickly. They took it offline and essentially just said, we didn't, you know, and they'd read the book. And they just said, we didn't even think about, you know, contacting them. And so that started, I then wrote an op-ed for the New York Times where I sort of laid this out and essentially said, really? We're still not asking the Lacks family? And a lot of scientists had had a similar response online. They saw the genome published and said, of course we're curious what's in her genes, but we wouldn't have done this without asking her family. So that really kind of broke the story open in terms of we're still dealing with these questions. People are, you know, the laws still don't clearly regulate, you know, what can be done with ourselves and who, what kind of consent you have to get. And so then in the months following that, a conversation happened between the Lacks family, the NIH, and I was in the room. I sort of gathered the people together, the NIH, a bioethicist from Hopkins, who the family has grown to know and trust. And we sort of sat down and essentially the scientists in the room sort of said, okay, let's back up. And this was Francis Collins, the director of the NIH, and Kathy Hudson there. And they said, let's start with, here's what a gene is. Here's what a genome is. And so essentially they said, we want to try to get informed consent now, even though, you know, it should have happened before this. And that's really where the conversation started.
This isn't about money. I mean, the okay. use of the HeLaCells, they've used them to develop untold numbers of drugs and so forth. But her descendants aren't after, or they're not, this isn't about getting a cut from any of that.
Right. I mean, it's pretty clear at this point that, you know, there are a lot of people who feel that her family does deserve money. There are mm-hmm. people who feel that they don't. But in this particular case, it was very clear to them, this isn't about that. This is about our family's privacy. This is about sort of clarifying the laws that are still, you know, they're still sort of not keeping up with the science. And, you know, I think for the Lacks family, it was also, okay, this is the third generation of Lackses that have been pulled into this. One thing we know from the history of HeLaCells is every few decades, something is going to happen that's going to lead scientists back to her family in some way. And so I think this current generation of Lackses, and this is Henrietta's grandkids and a couple of her great-grandkids, are saying, okay, enough. This stops with us. We want to have a voice in future HeLa research, you know, particularly with the genome, so that we know what's going on, so our children, our grandchildren, don't have the same experiences that now the last three generations of Lackses have had.
Has this changed the family?
Oh, yeah, I think in many ways. You know, the one of the things that's sort of exciting about this time in the Lack family's relationship with the HeLa cells and the genome is that, you know, the current generation of Lackses is the first generation that grew up learning anything about the HeLa cells. So, you know, Henrietta's children were never told what was happening with the cells. They really weren't even given information about what the cells were. And, you know, Henrietta's grandkids are now in their 30s. And so, you know, they grew up, there was this journalist hanging around the house, you know, with their family for the last, you know, 14 years and talking about the cells. And so, and they've, you know, followed all the media coverage of it. They've begun speaking publicly a lot at universities and various other events about their family and the cells. And so it's the first generation to be involved in the information and really really understand what the cells are and what's going on with them. Also the first college-educated generation of Lackses. Several of them have either completed grad school or are in grad school. You know, and so they're getting involved in a way that's pretty amazing and I think is very, in some ways, exciting for the family to say, okay, we are now part of this discussion. So part of what happened with this NIH discussion is that they came to the agreement that the NIH would only release this genome, the HeLa cell genome, with restrictions that made it so not anybody in the world could just download it, which was the way it was initially. But also, you know, you have to be an actual scientist doing biomedical research to get access to it. And you have to disclose any potential commercial interest you have in the genome. And you also have to agree not to contact the Lacks family for future research or anything. And you have to agree to acknowledge Henrietta as the source of the HeLa cells. And, you know, and then they created this board, a group of, I think it's six scientists and two members of the Lacks family. It was four scientists, I think, and two members of the Lacks family who will actually vet all these applications. And so now they've created an official HeLa committee that gives the family a voice in what research is going to happen in the future, which is really historic. It's just not happened with anything, mm-hmm. particularly the Lacks family.
Well, I can't imagine getting in the same room with the head of the NIH. It's interesting, the immortal life of Henrietta Lacks and how this is going to ripple down through the generations forever.
Yeah, I think for the Lacks family, for sure.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
One of the things that's been incredible for me is, you know, I feel like it's in the past, their story was not theirs. You know, their information was out there, both in terms of their family's story and their genetic information without their control. Often a lot of the stories that were published about them were not correct. And, you know, so one of the things that's been wonderful for me to watch is essentially them taking their story back and mm-hmm. saying, yes, okay, this is our story. It is out there now. You know, it's sort of been told in full, and now they're going to take it forward. So they're doing a lot of public speaking, and they're out there talking to the media now for the first time and being taken seriously by scientists and journalists. And, you know, to me, that's a pretty wonderful outcome. And I think that it also has, you know, what's going on with them right now will have effects on everyone in some ways, because, you know, when the book was published, the afterword, I talk about the fact that the laws are a bit out of date, you know, that consent still isn't required for all tissue research. And a lot of it does happen without people's knowledge still. And there's been a lot of discussion about how to fix that. And it's sort of been stagnant. And I think one of the things that this does is set the stage for that discussion and say, okay, we've done this with the Lacks family. Now, how do we carry this over so it, you know, protects, so everyone is protected.
Rebecca Skloot, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And congratulations on your success in the process of this. I know that it was a long time coming.
Thank you.
Rebecca Skloot, she's a science journalist and author of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. We'll continue with Wellness Wednesday when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. When it comes to getting a good night's sleep, our bedtime companions can make all the difference. Many people put up with snoring or blanket hogs or even sleepwalkers. But what about snuggling up with 1,000 tiny arthropods that hide in your sheets and suck your blood? I'm talking, of course, about bedbugs, which have made an itchy comeback in the U.S. and continue to plague every major city in Ohio. And in an effort to spread awareness about bedbugs' do's and don'ts, Ohio State University Extension has produced two public service announcements that aired recently on television stations across the state. Susan Jones, a professor of entomology at Ohio State, coordinated the PSAs, and she's a household insect expert for the state. She joins us once again in the studio today, and she's brought us some bedbugs, which I'm hoping are in a very tightly sealed container. She says they're double contained.
They're double contained.
And they're taped and everything. Welcome back.
Oh, thank you, Ann.
Yeah, they are weird looking, but maybe it's just the fact that they're all so many of them together. Do they often appear in groups like this?
They certainly do. They have an aggregation pheromone, a chemical.
They're social.
Well, they're not true social insects, but they definitely do like to hang out together.
So one of the things we talked about this about 3 years ago, and one of the amazing things is the spread, which you predicted.
Yes, this is something that is not going away. These bugs are hitchhikers. They will climb into someone's suitcase or backpack or briefcase, and that person will unknowingly carry these bugs and spread them to a new location. They also will readily move on their own. So if you're in multifamily housing and your neighbor has bed bugs, there's a good chance that you can get them because they will travel between the walls. They will travel down the hallway. This is just a very, very difficult insect to deal with.
We are there. Blood of choice.
That's
our
right.
Blood is the blood of choice for them. Do we understand what that connection is?
It seems to be a long, long history of bed bugs being associated with humans. There's some evidence that they originated from a bat bug that was living in caves on bats. And then when humans moved into the caves, some of these bugs evolved and were transported by humans. And so we have a close relative, the bat bug, which looks very much like a bed bug. You have to have a specialist examine it under the microscope. And until about 10 years ago at the Plant and Pest Diagnostic Clinic at OSU, the only samples we were receiving were bat bugs. We still receive bat bugs, but the predominant insect that is the bed bug, not the bat bug.
Now, they're double sealed, so
yes.
They will not get loose into the studio. But what will happen to these bed bugs if they don't get fed soon?
Oh, if they don't get fed soon, they will just be able to survive for months and months and months without a blood meal.
How do they do that?
They just slow down their metabolic processes. They're a very long-lived insect anyway, and so they can live for about a year.
Without food?
No, with food. They
okay.
can live for about a year. Without food, it depends on the temperature and it depends on the stage. But we were in an apartment, well, actually in a house that had been vacated by the resident. And we were finding live bed bugs 5 months later, still crawling around the residence.
With nothing, ostensibly nothing.
They were as flat as a pancake, to use that
terminology. But they were
alive. They were still alive. They were still walking around. And when we were in there, they were trying to climb on us and feed on us.
Huh. Okay. My guest is Susan Jones. She's a professor of entomology at OSU and a household insect expert. We're talking about bed bugs. We've talked about it before. They're not going away, folks. If you have a question or comment for Professor Jones, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. So you coordinated three public service announcements with OSU's Integrated Pest Management Program, and they've aired on television stations around the state. Let's listen to one of them.
Okay.
You don't think you can get bed bugs?
Think again.
They don't care.
What you look like. They don't care.
If you're old.
Or young.
They don't care how much money you have.
from the city to the country and everywhere in between.
Anyone can get bed bugs.
It's almost impossible to get rid of bed bugs on your own.
A licensed pest control professional can help. Brought to you by the Ohio State University Extension Integrated Pest Management Program.
I can't help it, but I start feeling like
that's a very normal reaction.
Check it out. But this is a really still remains a big deal. Anybody can get bed bugs. People who go to fancy hotels and stay at fancy spas and resorts, they're there as well.
That's correct. And we have to overcome this stigma associated with bed bugs. It's something that is a historical event, and people, particularly elderly people, don't want to talk about having bed bugs. The truth of the matter is, if you are a living, breathing human being, you provide all the cues that bed bug needs. And so virtually anyone is susceptible.
Can you get them at the doctor's office?
If a patient has come in prior to you and has a heavy infestation and some of the bugs dropped off of their clothing or came out of their purse or briefcase, and they were in a chair and you sat in that same chair, then theoretically you could get bed bugs. It's typically when someone has a heavy infestation that they are transporting bed bugs with them as they move from location to location. It's more likely that you would get them after an overnight stay with someone who had bed bugs or at an establishment that had bed bugs, because the bugs are primarily active at nighttime. They will move around during the daytime, particularly when the population is very high, but their natural cycle is to be active at nighttime.
And they, okay, and so that's, ergo, bed bugs, and they mostly hang out right in the creases and the seams of the bed.
Well, people have a misperception about that. They think if they get rid of the mattress and the box springs or the bed frame that they've gotten rid of all their bed bugs. Hmm. No, that is a prime location, but
to see that they're there.
Be in other places as well. They'll be behind the baseboards. They'll be behind the picture that is hanging above the bed. They may be in the curtains. And so they're called bed bugs because that is a common place to find them, but they can be anywhere from floor to ceiling.
It mentions in the PSA, and you've said it before, get a professional. Even if you're getting a professional, what should you know about that professional? What should you be looking for?
Okay, whenever you hire a professional, you should get at least 3 estimates from companies. And it's not necessarily the highest cost will be the most effective. It sometimes will be somewhere in the between. It may be the low estimate. You want to see what approach they're using, how thorough they are going to be, and get references from them and follow up with those references. Find out if they were satisfied with the treatment, how long it took to get rid of the bed bugs. Or in general, it takes 3 insecticide treatments to get rid of bed bugs. So this has to do with their life cycle. It takes about 7-10 days for the egg to hatch. The egg oftentimes is not permeable to some insecticides. And so as those new first stage immature bugs, the nymphs, come out of the egg, they then will start feeding. And so you'll have the population ongoing. And so you come back and do a second treatment. You may have to do a third treatment because these bugs will hide in virtually any crack and crevice.
And also, you're talking about insecticide treatments, but there's also the heat treatment.
There is also another way of treating for bed bugs. It's whole house heat treatments, whole unit heat treatments. And this is with a professional. It's generally about a 6 to 8 hour process the company will have to be turning your furniture, distributing your clothing, and they will have temperature probes deep in those items. And they're making sure that the temperature gets up to 135 for a sustained period of time. So it's not just a matter of you raising the temperature in your house and hoping to kill the bed bugs that way. What you're likely to do by just raising the temperature in your home is speed up the life cycle so they'll have more generations. You have to get to a critical temperature and keep it at that temperature for a sustained period of time.
Carrie in Reynoldsburg, you're on the air. Hi, Carrie.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was wondering, when I buy new clothes, what can I do to minimize the risk of bringing bed bugs home with me that way?
Okay. When you buy new clothes, I would suggest that you immediately put them into your dryer. And for your dryer, it needs to be at 120 degrees, which is usually moderate to high heat, and you let those dry items tumble around for 30 minutes. 30 minutes and 120, those are the two key elements for getting rid of them.
What about clothes that need dry cleaning? Can you just bring them straight to the dry cleaners?
You can bring them straight to the dry cleaners, and the dry cleaning process would kill all life stages.
Okay, good question. Thank you, Carrie. Is it typical to pick up bed bugs, or is it becoming more typical at clothing stores?
It's not a very typical scenario, but I think that stores need to change their return policy, because in the past, it has been when somebody returns an item, it is immediately put out on the floor or in that warehouse. It needs to be disinfected before it's put out on the floor or in the warehouse.
All right. Who thought? Who knew? John in Delaware, you're on the air with Susan Jones. She is a professor of entomology at OSU. Welcome.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Love the show, especially the creepy ones like this.
Thanks, John.
I just had a question. I mean, I've never heard of bed bugs until, you know, up to the last 5 years or so. Where did they come from? I mean, were they like the mosquitoes sucking on the dinosaurs back in, or, you know, how long have they been around?
Bed bugs have been around for tens of thousands of years. If you would have a conversation or would have been able to have a conversation with, say, your great-grandparents, they would have told you about dealing with bed bugs. Bed bugs were pretty much eliminated in the United States by the 1950s. And what happened was we had a synthetic chemical introduced to the market, DDT. It was very effective in getting rid of bed bugs. But the bed bugs developed resistance to DDT within a matter of years. But the literature said, if bed bugs have developed resistance to DDT, we now suggest that you go to these other long-lasting chemistries. And so in the United States, over the years, since the 1950s, there's been a push to limit the types of chemistries that are available. And so bed bugs have developed resistance to pyrethroid-type insecticides, which are the predominant insecticide that you buy in over-the-counter products.
And you don't recommend any over-the-counter products?
Over-the-counter products will not get rid of your bed bug infestation. We did a research study last year and published it about bug bombs, over-the-counter total release aerosols, these bug bombs that you you release and you walk out of the house because the insecticide mist is going to be everywhere. It did nothing to control the bed bugs. And in fact, there's evidence that it causes bed bugs to scatter. So if you're in an apartment complex and you use a bug bomb, there's a good chance you are now spreading the bed bugs to your neighbor, as well as spreading it not just in your bedroom, but in your living room, your bathroom, your kitchen. So bug bombs in particular are not the way to go for bed bugs.
Okay, John, thanks for that question. Email from Mary Jo. She writes, are there effective devices to attract the bugs so that you can test if they are present? I need to figure out if it is safe to bring some furniture and boxed household goods into my house from elsewhere. That's a good question.
That is a very good question. And we have been doing quite a bit of research on a new detection device. It's called the Verify Bed Bug Detector, V-E-R-I-F-I. It's from FMC. And of all of the products that we have looked at on the market, the Verify Bed Bug Detector, in my opinion, is the best product that's out there. It's a little rectangular box. It has several active components, so it's actively drawing the bed bugs into a pitfall area, a little slick-sided area where they can't escape. It has both a pheromone and a chiromone. A pheromone is a chemical that tells the bed bugs, there are other bed bugs hanging out here. A chiromone means that it smells like a host. So to other bed bugs, it's going to say, there's a human in the vicinity here. And those components last for 90 days. There's also a carbon dioxide component, but it only lasts for 24 hours. So with these three components, it will actively draw the bed bugs in. And this is something that I think is the best active detector that we have out on the market.
Smart to do as far as taking something in from another place, though. You're not necessarily going to know if they're in that, if they're coming from that mattress or coming from that box, because you're not going to bring them into your house until you know they're not there.
That's right.
Kind of a conundrum in a way. But
you need to inspect everything before you bring it into your house. And for me, I have totally changed my behavior where I will no longer bring upholstered used furniture into my house just because the bugs can hide in so many places. We have the bed bugs here, and you can see all the black fecal spotting that is in the container with them. That is a telltale sign where the bed bugs are hanging out, is this black, their fecal droppings that they're leaving behind.
Yeah, they got a lot of fecal droppings over here in this little container. Let's try to squeeze in a couple more. Robert from Delaware, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Dan. Mm-hmm. I'm as creeped out by these things as you are, I think. I think there's a reason you haven't had her back in 3 years. And that's supposed to...
I just keep hoping they'll just go away. Susan's very nice.
We don't even want to think about them.
Right.
But I haven't been to a movie theater in about 3 years. And then I turn around, we get go bowling the other day and already paid, and there we look down and there are cloth seats, you know, so you can't get away from it. But my thinking is if places like bowling alleys and theaters use some kind of leather instead of cloth, would that help restrain some of this growth?
Well, that brings up a couple questions, Robert. I'm glad you called, and thanks for listening. I mean, are public places, accommodations, whether they're hotels, are they spraying or treating for these things, assuming because of the public, the large public, transients?
As he indicated, furnishings do make a difference in bedbugs' ability to cling to surfaces. However, leather would not be something that they would avoid. They would want to cling to leather the same way they would to fabric. Some sort of slick plastic, which we would find less appealing to sit on, would also be less appealing to the bedbugs. Fewer carpeted surfaces. If we had more tile, more linoleum, that would definitely reduce the number of hiding places. When I go into a hotel and I see very plush furnishings, I shudder because it's offering lots of hiding places for bed bugs. So Robert is right. We do have to think about our type of furnishings. But at these public places, yeah. they are bringing in canine teams.
They're aware that this is a problem. Yes. They don't want to turn out to be the source of a bed bug infestation.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. Well, that's good to know. Robert, thanks a lot for your call. Susan Jones, we just scratched the surface again. Hopefully, by the way, though, I wanted to go over some of those figures. Columbus ranks number fourth in the country in 2013 in this list of cities with the highest increases in bed bug infestations. Mm-hmm. A 47% increase.
Yeah. And these are numbers from a single pest control company. It's Terminix.
Right.
And, you know, they are going to not be equally represented across the country, but... And we get into situations where people can't afford to hire a pest control company. And so you have to figure all of those things into numbers from a national pest control company. But it does indicate that we definitely do have a problem here.
Well, thank you for talking about it today, and take these little bugs with you when you go.
Okay.
Susan Jones, professor of entomology at OSU and a household insect expert. Thanks again.
Oh, thank you.
We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. On October 1st, enrollment for new health insurance benefits under the Affordable Care Act begins. But if you live in Ohio and you are not a political wonk with an insurance background and psychic powers, chances are you know very little about how Obamacare, as the president calls it, will affect you, your family, and the state. That has inspired us to devote one segment of Wellness Wednesday each week now to untangling, bit by bit, issue by issue, the healthcare reform web. If you have questions or ideas for our series, send them by email to allsides@wosu.org. We can't guarantee we'll use them, but we appreciate your help. By the way, we're not the only ones trying to educate the public. According to data compiled by the Associated Press, advertising and publicity efforts for the healthcare changes will cost the feds and states at least $684 million. Joining us now to discuss this major ad campaign is Ann Sanner. She's a reporter for the Associated Press. Welcome to the show, Ann.
Thanks, Ann.
Who's taken up the campaign? Whose job is it to get people informed about the Affordable Care Act?
Yeah, well, it's going to be a variety of folks. You mentioned enrollment in the exchanges or open enrollment beginning in October. And the state has a federally facilitated exchange. And so a lot of that effort that you're going to see in terms of outreach is going to be... focused on health centers and community groups. So the federal government has these grants, which community groups are applying to get, and they're going to be basically educating the public about that effort. So these are some areas that people are already, talking to, doctors, providers like that. So they're going to know, okay, I think this person might qualify or might be eligible for the exchange. So we'll educate them about that.
That's a pretty casual way to go about it when you think about it. I mean, what if you're 24-year-old male, healthy, you don't have contact
right.
with somebody like a healthcare provider. Where's the general public going to get information from in Ohio?
Right. Well, there are going to be groups out there, and there is a group in Ohio called
okay.
Enroll America, and they're going to have offices opening in Columbus and Cincinnati and Cleveland. And part of what they're going to be doing is like door-to-door grassroots campaigns. So you might see them at a county fair passing out brochures about the Affordable Care Act. That's just one group that's going to be doing it. And I think when we get closer to that October 1st enrollment, that's the beginning. Now, coverage doesn't take effect until January. So
right.
there's going to be a chunk of time there where I think you'll see more more people coming out. It could be almost like a campaign, like here in the swing state.
Are all the states getting the same amount of money per capita?
No, not at all. You know, West Virginia, which is nearby, is getting, I think, like $9, more than $9 per capita. Here in Ohio, it's 53 cents. And that's because most of the grant money is coming from the federal government. Other places, states, state departments and state agencies are also putting out their own money to help community groups get the word out.
So why does West Virginia get $9 a person and Ohio 56 cents a person?
Well, that's just the public money. So that's just the public side of it. There might be private money that also would be.
So that's coming from the states choosing to spend that much money?
It's coming from the federal government and also the states.
Okay.
So in West Virginia, you know, their state government also might be chipping in to that federal pot of money that they're getting.
And is the federal government doling out the money equally per capita or not?
No, I don't believe so. So here in Ohio, for instance, we have this 53 cents and they've said, OK, we're going to give this much to community health centers and we're going to give another part or another chunk of money, like $2.3 million, to community groups who can apply for this grant money. And it's different for different states.
Okay.
And it's also different depending on how the exchange is set up. I mean, here in Ohio, it's a federally facilitated exchange, whereas in West Virginia, it's a federal-state partnership. So that's why the state has also...
Some states are already doing advertising. I've seen billboards in Michigan. I haven't seen them in Ohio. Doesn't mean they don't exist. Some states are way ahead of the curve and some are way behind the curve. What's the difference? Why is that?
Yeah, I think it's just because it's such a, you know, each state is taking a different approach toward implementing it. The law. And because the governor here has made the decision that the state is not going to run the exchange, is not going to be involved in that effort, then you're not going to see a lot of those billboards that might be put up by a state insurance department. The insurance department here has said, we're not going to have any kind of social media effort. We're not going to have any kind of a marketing campaign or outreach. Because the federal government's running that, we're going to leave it up to them. And however that money gets spent here, it's the money that they've devoted.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ann Sanner. She's a reporter for the Associated Press. And one of the things that she's been covering very closely is the Healthcare Reform Act. If you have a question or comment for her, we're talking about the marketing of it right now. October 1st is the day that registration, you know, it's time to sign up if you think you're eligible. If you want to learn more about that, there is a website that we can direct you to. Go to our website at wosu.org/allsides and we'll try to get you to that. This is going to be part of an ongoing series on Wellness Wednesday. Going forward, if you have ideas for other segments about Obamacare, give us a call, 614, not, don't call us, email us at allsides@wosu.org. If you have a question about the marketing campaign with Ann Sanner, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. In some states where there's not a lot of activity yet on an official level, private companies like Walgreens are even launching their own educational campaigns. Who's regulating what they say? Will all these messages confuse people? What's the thought behind that?
Well, there are a certain group of professionals that the Affordable Care Act created, and they're called navigators. And these are going to be counselors that basically facilitate enrollment. And the state of Ohio does have rules and regulations for that new group of professionals. And actually, they just kind of were working through the final rules this week about that. But the insurance department basically has said, you have to be certified, you have to have training, you have to have a criminal background checked. So those people will be vetted before helping people enroll. Now, this is for navigators only, and that's a certain distinction that that is made under the law in terms of helping people.
And one of the things they're sussing out this week is whether or not nonprofit organizations, churches, and, you know, maybe
clinics and what, you know, whether or not they have to go through this training process or what they're going to be able to do to help.
Right. And part of what is being debated and part of what came up this week is whether or not the state rules allow that. And the indication that was given at a hearing at the State House this week was that as long as they're not purporting to be navigators, as long as they're not holding themselves out to be these so-called navigators, mm-hmm. then they can go ahead with their day-to-day activities. They can go ahead and do the services that they provide.
Is enrollment going to be complicated for a typical, they're what, we're talking about 16% of the population currently uninsured. Are they going to have a problem? Is it going to be tough to do?
Well, you know, our writers in Washington are still working that out. And I think, you know, some of the stories that I've seen from them are comparing it to almost like buying a car. It's going to be a complicated transaction. It's not going to almost be like airline prices on Travelocity, where you go on and you look. It won't be exactly like that, but it's going to be a more complicated exchange. You might be calling a call center to ask questions and get more kind of guidance from these call centers. So some of that online configuration remains to be worked out, but that's kind of the latest, that it's almost more like car shopping than airline ticket
because
prices.
You'll have choices.
Yes. You know, if you meet certain qualifications right now, if you're uninsured, you would go online, you would look and compare plans and see what plan, you know, best fits your family's needs. And then also, yeah, at that point, it would be determined what kind of government subsidy you could get, because you're going to get some help to pay for that coverage. So that's all kind of being worked out in terms of what the consumer might see and how the consumer will, I guess, engage in that.
Now, there have been delays in some aspects of the Affordable Care Act, but that has not delayed in any way this entire enrollment process.
Correct. Open enrollment begins October 1st.
No matter what. So people who, that is just, we keep hearing about delays and that sort of thing in the headlines, but that doesn't have anything to do with the individual.
Correct.
At this point. Michael in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Michael.
Hey, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Good topic. I'm involved somewhat with the Navigator Grants, and I just wanted to make a comment, and I'll let you respond. I think your guest is being terribly polite about the Department of Insurance and the way this has been treated. This has been very political. The Department of Insurance has done everything it can to undermine implementation in the state, and they've been very upfront about that. The lieutenant governor's been very upfront about that as her purpose.
She is in charge of the Department of Insurance, right?
That's right. That's right. So they've not done things they could have done, like advertising, like get information out. Even the information they've gotten out has been criticized by Kaiser and other more objective groups as being a misrepresentation of the costs, because it didn't include the subsidies and the tax credits and other things that are going to be there.
Okay.
So I just think you're being really fair, which I understand reporters do that. But on the other hand, you're missing the point, which is there's been a very purposeful, politically motivated approach to this, and it has not helped the implementation process. And I'll listen to the answers off the phone.
All right, Michael, thank you for the call. Ohio has been criticized for that. Ohio certainly is not alone in being criticized for that.
Right. I think that there have been other GOP-led states that have gotten some criticism directed at them as well for how they are approaching this.
So are Ohioans at a disadvantage because we live in a state where it's opposed, where the policy of Affordable Care Act is opposed by the governor?
I think that's a good question. I think we'll just have to see how the law plays out here. Certainly, while the state isn't doing these marketing efforts, isn't, you know, applying for additional funds to help with outreach and things like that, there will be groups. There are groups here on the ground that are doing outreach themselves. So you might see that gap be filled, even if there is some resistance, you know, from the state to be getting involved in that.
And it won't help to go to other states' websites because every state will be different.
Right, right. For instance, you know, it is a federally facilitated exchange here. West Virginia has that federal-state partnership. There are other states that have their own run, like they're running the exchange. So they're
right.
Kind of doing that web interface themselves. So they're setting that up. So it would be completely different.
As I mentioned earlier, the biggest changes will affect about 16% of the population currently uninsured. Are they a tough group to reach? What type of people tend to be uninsured? What are the marketing experts saying about this task?
Yeah, I mean, there's going to be a younger population. Certainly, I think younger males might be harder to reach, but some of the campaign efforts you see might be similar to, similar to marketing efforts during a political campaign. Like, they'll find a way to reach those populations. And from the group here on the ground in rural America, they're talking about direct contact with these people. So going
door to door.
Correct. So door to door and, you know, getting out where the general population is. So whether that's at like a county fair or whether that's at a local like farmer's market, just being there to have kind of the most contact.
I would imagine that there's a way to a certain degree to target neighborhoods most likely to have more than not people who are uninsured.
Right. And I think, you know, that what they're also focused on is training volunteers. So okay. They've been doing kind of like a house warming, almost like open house for these volunteers to say, okay, this is how you're going to approach someone and this is how you're going to talk to them or educate them or let them know that this is going on. So those efforts are underway, and I think that'll continue to be ramped up when you get closer to the October 1st deadline.
Well, Ann Sanner, thank you for joining us today to talk about it. I hope you'll come back again. I'm sure there's going to be more questions down the road.
Yes, definitely.
Ann Sanner, she's a reporter for the Associated Press. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.